Welcome to the For Narcotics Anonymous podcast. Here we share audio recordings of NA members sharing their experience, strength, and hope. If you are a drug addict or think you have a drug problem, you are welcome to attend an NA meeting. Go to www.nahelp.org/meetings to find a meeting near you. On this website, you will also find more information about the Narcotics Anonymous program. Thanks for listening to this recording.
The recording has begun, and Vito will turn the meeting over to you.
Thank you, Paul. I'm an addict called Vito. And I first of all, I'd like to thank Paul and this group who asked me to come here and share. It's always a privilege to share at a Narcotics Anonymous meeting. I was supposed to share here in October, but I wound up in the hospital. Unfortunately, I had open bypass surgery a year ago or 11 months ago, and it's been a rough year coming back, but I'm back. And I guess I was going to wherever you go, and God said, get the hell back. You got more service to do. So here I am. I'm celebrating 64 years clean today. I watch Narcotics Anonymous go to finding a meeting every couple hundred miles so you can walk to a meeting every night. At least where I live in Florida, we can walk to a meeting every night if we chose to. And that's how powerful and growth that this has come over the 64 years. When I walked in here on Valentine's Day, February 14th, 1960, there were very few NA meetings around, and we had to go to the other fellowship just to supplement our recovery until we were able to build enough meetings. And that's what we did. We built one meeting at a time, got a resentment, grabbed the coffee pot, and built another resentment. And you know, that process is still going on today, except it even gets bigger. It's building resentments in areas, resentments in regions. But you know, God always has a plan. Show me a resentment, I show God trying to break through and have more growth involved into it. So resentments can be bad, but in some cases they can spur a lot of growth. I don't like to go into a war story very much because we all have our own war story. So I'll briefly talk a couple minutes on my addiction, but then I'm going to talk on the solution. And for me, the solution is the 12 steps of Narcotics Anonymous. That is the key for how we go. And if we're going into rehabs, jails, in other places, and we're coming in only with our war stories, basically, we're not carrying the message, we're carrying the mess. So it's okay to bring it in there. Excuse me, I'm a little hoarse this morning. But we have to bring the steps in because that's the solution. So I grew up in a place called the Bronx in New York City. And I came from a one-parent family. My father went out for a loaf of bread, never came back. That's to put it briefly. And so my mother was a very independent woman back in the 1940s. She decided to work 3-4 jobs just to support us. And so that left me available on the streets. And, you know, in New York, there's a lot of large buildings. And we hung out in the front of the building on a place called the Stoop in the front of the building. And I was a young guy, and I wanted to fit in with the older guys who were the only ones out there. And I became sort of the neighborhood gopher. I'd run here, do all kinds of favors for them. And they would reward me with pot. And a starter drug in New York back in those days, you probably never heard of it today, was called Carbona. And what Carbona was dry cleaning fluid or spot remover. And we used to soak our handkerchiefs into it, sniff it all day long. And then we're 6-7 years old in school. And the teachers would say, this neighborhood, everybody's sick. They all got handkerchiefs sniffing all day long. And what we were doing was getting high on Carbona. By the time I was 10 years old, I started mainlining heroin. And heroin was my drug of choice for 10 years. I did what I needed to do to support that habit. It didn't matter if I had to put a gun to your head, go into a fire escape into your window, steal whatever it is. I did what I needed to do to support my habit. And that all ended on the night of February 13th in a place called Brick Church Station in East Orange, New Jersey. It was a commuter station going into the state, into the city. And I was living in a dumpster for almost a year prior to that. And I crawled out of that dumpster that day to make my last score at the station, do a hustle there, and I fell in the snow. And the snow was covering me. People were stepping over me as they were going to catch the commuter trains, and somebody took some sympathy on me, called for an ambulance, and that wasn't easy back in those days because, you know, we didn't have cell phones. You had to find one of those things that where Superman changed his clothes, called a full phone booth, put money into it, call for an ambulance, and so forth. But that did happen, and they took me to a hospital, and I was admitted with a word which is very popular in my life today called service. And service was a very sort of an undercover word to say, you got no funds, we're admitting you under welfare. So I was admitted under service. And of course, I didn't have any money or anything. So they had assigned me a doctor who was actually an intern in that hospital. He was from Greece and he was interning in the United States. And he told me that I was contagious because I was suffering from both infectious and serum hepatitis from dirty needles and dirty living, and that I would be put into what was known as an isolation ward because I was contagious. Nobody could go in there except medical staff. And he was taking care of me for the 3-4 weeks that I was in that isolation ward. And he came to me just before I was ready to get out of there. He says, Vito, he says, the man comes here. They want to question you, find out why you were in this, living in this condition and so forth, but they can't see you because you're contagious. But you're going to be getting out of here in a few days. And I'm going to offer you a deal. Now, when an addict hears the word deal, your ears get big like Dumbo the elephant. Because deal, that means like, what's going on here? And he said, we got a place upstairs for people similar to you. But if you would sign these papers, we would put you there and they won't be able to bother you. Now, I'm not the smartest person in the world or the brightest street lamp on the street. But a deal. I go someplace. It's still winter. I'm in the northern part, northeastern part of the United States. It's cold. Somebody probably have taken possession of my dumpster. So I'm not a fool. I said, yes, because they'll feed me 3 hots a day, a bed. And so I signed the papers and everything that I own fitted into a brown paper bag. And we went on the elevator and we went up to, I think it was the 6th or 7th floor. I can't remember anymore. But we went up to that floor and the elevator opened up. There's a great big room. And there was bed after bed after bed, almost like an army barracks, it reminded me of. And I says to the nurse, what is this place? And she says, well, it's an alcoholic ward. And I looked at her in disgust. I said, why would you put me with all those sick people? Because back then, my mind, there was a difference between alcohol and drugs. You know, and I would say, they're sick people. They can't stop drinking. I don't want to be around people that are sick. And she says, but you're an addict. I said, yeah, but I'm not no alcoholic. Why would you want to put me in with them? She said, well, you're free to leave. You can take your brown paper bag and leave. But if you come in here, you have to follow our rules. And I said, rules? What kind of rules? She said, well, once a week, we have people from the AA Fellowship come in. And they bring a message every Wednesday night, and you have to be here. I said, why do I have to be here and listen to those disgusting people? Can I go get coffee or leave? No. If you want to leave, leave now. Take your brown paper bag and go. And as I said, I'm not a fool. I decided to go. So I found a bed in the corner where there was a wall on both sides and a wall towards my back. The only place that was open, my front. Because as addicts, especially male addicts, we don't want anybody near our back. We don't like to be exposed. So I figured that'd be a good place to go. Because remember, I was with all these sick people. And so I was there, and these people would come in once a week with this meeting. And I would stand against the wall, and I would laugh at them. Because they couldn't handle life, they couldn't, and they always wanted to drink, not realizing that I didn't have any problem handling life because I was stoned all the time. And if anybody knows opiates, you go to Never Never Land. I would shoot up, I'd go to Never Never Land. Of course, I didn't have a problem in the world until I start coming down. The razor blades were in my belly, and I had to fix myself before I get sick again. So, you know, I started to listen to them. But one thing happened in that facility that changed my life and why I am here today. I met this old man. Now, when I say old man, I got to be very careful because I'm a kid now, 20 years old, and there's a man 40 years old. And to me, he was ancient. Today, I'd like to go back to that age again because I'm in my mid-80s, and 40 seems awful young to me. But, you know, I got friendly with him, and he was like most addicted people. You want to talk to him about God, he was on a first-name basis with God. We were having a Cold War with the Soviet Union at that time called the Iron Curtain. And he knew how to solve it. At least he said he knew how. So I look at this man like he was a great philosopher. I didn't have a dad, so he was a man that sort of filled in there. And I thought this was the greatest man in the world. And then we wore these hospital gowns in this facility where your butt sticks out in the back. And when it was time for him to go home, he had to go into the back room and put his street clothes on. And when he came out, he was dressed as a Skid Row bum. Now, he had holes in his shoes, holes in his pants. Well, he wore a navy peacoat with the elbows out. You know, today, guys wear jeans with holes in them. It's fashionable. But back then, it wasn't. It was a sign of poverty. And I looked at this man, and this man was a Skid Row bum. But I looked into his eyes, and for the first time in my life, I realized there was no difference between me and him, except our drug of choice. He'd get off with cheap wines like Sneaky Pete, Thunderbird, Gallo, things like that. And me as an addict, I'd get off on anything, get my hands up. I remember in that dumpster looking for stale bread and hair tonic to strain through the stale bread so I can get the alcohol out of it and get off when I couldn't get anything else. So I realized really there wasn't much difference between me and him except the drug of choice. And so when he was left, I began to listen to those people when they came in. And I went beyond the substance and could feel an identification with the feelings and their stories and everything. And then when it was time for me to leave that facility, they handed me a meeting list of the other fellowship. And they said to me, kid, if you go there, they have coffee, cookies, and donuts. Now, when you're a homeless people, that's a pretty big invite. So the first day that I got off, I found their meeting and I walked in. And it's like the world stood still, because when I walked in, here I am as a young kid with hair down to my ass. I got earrings down to my shoulders. My Garrison belt and boots have spikes sticking out of them for self-defense. And I walk in there and the guys had ties on and jackets. And that's how they dressed back in that fellowship in those days. The girls were all dressed up. And it seemed like everything was in slow motion. Finally, this old dude come up to me and he said, hey, kid, what are you doing here? And I said, I just got out of this hospital. They gave me this meeting list. They said, if I come here, I can get coffee, cookies, and donuts. And this is a place for me to go. And he said, well, the coffee, cookies, and donuts are over there, kid. But this is a closed meeting for alcoholics only. And you are not welcome because people like you don't get better. You suffer from a disease that is illegal and immoral. And people like you just never get better. But he took the meeting list and he said, but you can go to these big open meetings that you don't have to be an alcoholic to go to. But don't bother, kid. People like you never get better. Well, one thing you don't tell an addict is don't to come back. So I started going to these big open meetings. And I remember the first one that I went to was in a place in Newark, New Jersey, right along the Garden State Parkway. Great big billboard of Pabst Blue Ribbon beer right up above the church. And they had an AA meeting in there. And I walk up to the church. And I see all these guys around. And they I could tell immediately they were addicts. They had long hair. They had dirty jeans, dirty T-shirts on and everything. So I knew it was my people, so I gravitated towards them. And then when it was time for the meeting to start, we all went in as a group, and we sat down, and everybody in that meeting shifted to the other side of the room. They thought what we had, they would catch. But I went to that meeting for a couple months, and finally somebody tapped me on the shoulder by a nickname they gave me there. It was Animal. They said, hey, Animal, there's a drug meeting in the back room. Now, I wasn't quite sure what they meant, but myself and the herd of animals, we went to the back room. And when we got there, there was a bunch of hippies of that generation. Now, we were street people, which were different than the hippies. We were all the same age. They had long hair. Their hair was clean, and they were dressed nice and clean. And we were just street people. And they said they come from San Diego, California, and they were carrying a message called Narcotics Anonymous. Now, I knew the name Narcotics Anonymous because there was another fellowship in New York that started in 1949. And they wasn't this fellowship, but they had the name. They copyrighted the first ones that had it. And so I went there back in 1959, and I got clean actually a year in that fellowship. And a girl was sponsored me by the name of Ray Lopez. And I relapsed. And you know, I never went back because of the fact that I thought it was her fault that I relapsed. You know, newcomers relapse because they want to blame their sponsors. But I knew the name Narcotics Anonymous, but it was a different N.A., and this N.A. had a couple pieces of literature. They had an off-colored white book, and they had a couple pieces of literature down there. And they opened up this meeting, and they started talking. And our first time in my life, I heard my thinking coming out of somebody else's mouth. And I had that big, deep feeling of relating. And I knew for I was not alone, because I've always thought that if you knew what was going on inside my head, you would lock me up forever. Because my mother used to have a favorite expression to me. She says, your grandfather was crazy, your father was crazy, and you're crazy too. So So most of my life, I figured I was crazy. I remember back in high school, I'd always get in trouble. And when I was in the principal's office, I'd say, why are you the way you are? And I said, you got to understand, my grandfather was crazy, my father was crazy, and I'm crazy too. What do you expect from me? And you know, so I always thought that there was something a little wrong with me. And so finally, I hear all these other people thinking, they're talking with my thinking. I knew I would never be alone again because there are people like me. And this meeting lasted for not too long. It was here and then it disappeared. And back in the early days, they had what they called rabbit meetings. The rabbit meeting would be here today and gone somewhere else the next day. And these people had gone on. But I had copied this one guy's phone number and he went back to San Diego and I would call him up. And, you know, we started some NA meetings, but they wouldn't last. And I'm talking to him on the phone. I said, we're starting these meetings, but they die fast. And he says, well, why? What do you think's happening? I said, because all the women are in AA. We get the guys, they get a week clean and so forth. They get horny and they go to the other fellowship, you know, because there was no really women in NA in those days. He said, well, why don't you come out to San Diego? We got some NA going out here. And I says to him, well, I really can't relocate. I can't go cross country. I got a living to make. And he said to me, what are you talking about? He said, you don't work. I said, yeah, but you don't understand. And back in those days, if you were an addict or an alcoholic, you were considered disabled and you were able to get welfare. You can't get it today, but back then you used to. So I says to him, I get this thing called welfare. I get two checks a month from the state. I cash the money. I go to the pool hall and I play nine ball all day long and parlay my money. And I says, I got a job to do. I can't pick up and go to California. He said, Vito, don't worry about it. We got welfare out here and we got pool rooms. So I hitchhiked across the United States. It took me almost 2 weeks to go from New Jersey off to California. And when I got to California, I remember it was a Wednesday morning, and I found one of these phone booths that Superman changed his clothes in, and I called this guy. Now, you got to remember, we had no cell phones, and when you wanted to use a phone, it cost money. But if you were a street person, you learned one thing about the phone company. If you took the top part of the receiver and you unscrewed it, underneath was a little receiver, and underneath the receiver was two silver prongs. And when you dial somebody, for instance, operator, I want San Diego, boop, 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 boop. She'd say, deposit 75 cents, which was a lot of money back in the 60s. You take those silver prongs and hit it against the quarter slot, and it'd go ding, ding, ding. Thank you for your deposit. So we had cell phones, but they were on the corners. So I called this guy up, and I said to him, I said, I'm here in San Diego. He said, where are you? I give him the location of where I'm at. He says, stay there. I'll be there and pick you up in a few minutes. I'm not that far away. So he pulls up with this red hippie Volkswagen bus with peace signs all over it. Now, remember, I'm a street person. I'm a little embarrassed to get in one of these hippie vans. But I get into them. They took me to this pad, which was near Old Town in San Diego. And all day long, addicts are coming in and out. And he says, we got it made here. He said, we got two NA meetings in a week. And that was a big deal back in 1960, even in California. And so he said, today is Wednesday. We got two meetings, one on Wednesday and one Friday night. We're going to NA tonight. So about 5, 6 o'clock, whatever it was, we all pile into this Volkswagen bus. I think there was 15 people. And we go to this great big Catholic church in a place called Mission Hill. And we get out of this van. He grabs me by the hand. He says, Alfredo, in the parking lot and in the church, do not mention NA or Narcotics Anonymous. I said, I thought we were going to NA meeting. He said, we are. But the priest thinks we're AA. They don't rent to any addicts. So when I hear people saying, hey, we lost our meeting place, we can't find one, I laugh at them. I said, sure you can. We did it when it was impossible. The other NA meeting was in East San Diego on Friday nights. Our landlord didn't care who we were as long as we paid the rent. It was the Black Panther Clubhouse. So we had two NA meetings in a week. But what we had to do is go to the other fellowship to be able to survive, because you can't survive when you're a newcomer on two. But what we did is we started NA meetings and we worked hard and we built them up. Now, I got a few years clean now, and I got to be honest with everybody. I really wasn't doing the program the right way, because here I am a couple of years clean, never worked a damn step and never had a sponsor, because, you know, I'm all powerful. I can do it myself. But what was happening is people coming in after me were getting sponsors and working the steps, and they were getting better. And I was still jonesing on a daily basis. I wanted to use, and I would wait for somebody to relapse so I can rob them. You know, so I didn't have very much recovery. I was just clean. And so finally I said, maybe there's something with this God stuff and step stuff and sponsor stuff So I asked this guy, would you sponsor me? He said, yeah, Vito, I'll sponsor you, but where are you with the steps? And I looked at him like he's a fool. I said, what do you mean where I'm with steps? I heard him read every night for the last 2 years. I'm done. And we meet some people like that today. He said, okay, smartass, tell me about the first step. And I said to him, I admitted we were powerless over drugs in my life. And he said, wait a minute. Where does it say drugs in the first step? And I picked up this little off white book and it said, we admitted we were powerless over our addiction and their lives had become unmanageable. And I looked at him like, I said, what's the difference? Addiction, drugs, same word. He said, no, it's not the same thing. Addiction is that funny looking thing between your ears. Drugs is what you put into your body. The end result is addiction. And he said, you may be clean, but you're not in recovery. He said, because when we admit that we are powerless, that powerless word is not strong enough. Because we all said, oh, I got a problem. I'm powerless. He said, in the first step, it's a three-part phase. First, you admit you're powerless. Then you accept that you're powerless. And then you surrender to what you accept. So you're powerless. Then you wind up admitting it. And then you surrender to it. And that's why in the first step, there used to be a slogan back in the days when we used to use NA bumper stickers. It said, surrender to win. That was the first step slogan. We surrender to win. And so when we admitted that we were powerless, we surrendered, accepted, and everything down the thing. So it became an internal thing. And it said that it had been in our past. It doesn't say is, which means that before we came into NA, we had all this garbage. And now we're dealing with the garbage we brought in as well. And what the first step is very similar to is like taking all your clothes off, being in the main street of a city. And if you're standing there naked, you know you're going to see some sirens and flashing lights coming very soon. You're powerless. Well, you're not powerless over life. You're powerless over the disease of addiction. For instance, if I tell you to go turn the lights on, I'm not powerless. I can walk over and turn the light switch on. If they tell me to go out and get a job, I'm not powerless over that. I can go out and fill an application. Although I hear newcomers, I can't go out and get a job. I'm powerless. I'm new. No, I'm powerless over my disease. I'm not powerless over life. But the thing is, I become powerless in the first step, but I gain power in the next 11 steps through the steps in the God of my understanding. So I become powerless over my addiction in the first step, but I gain power over my addiction through the next 11 steps. The first three steps are the foundation of recovery. Now, they won't keep you clean forever. They will keep you clean for a while, but it is not okay to be physically clean and spiritually dirty. And you wind up getting physically clean 4 through 9, and then you get to maintain it in the growth from 10, 11, and 12. So in the second step, it said we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore sanity. And I said to my sponsor, I said, we'll skip 2 and 3. He said, why? I said, you don't understand. I'm different than everybody else. He said, okay, Vito, how are you different? I said, you got to understand, I'm an agnostic. And I used to love that word because it had a great sound. And he looked at me in the eyes and he pointed his finger at me. He said, okay, Vito, you're an agnostic. Tell me why you're not an atheist. Now, nobody ever asked that question before. And I went into my deep state of meditation and I said, just in case I die someday. Now, when you're 20 years old, you're never going to die. But just in case I die someday, and they happen to be one of these things called God, I want him to know I didn't deny him. I was an atheist. An agnostic. I just didn't know. And he looked at me and he said, Vito, he said, agnostic is nothing more than a chicken atheist. Can you imagine your sponsor saying something like that to you? But it made sense. It made sense. And he said, anyway, dummy, which was his favorite word for me, you don't meet God till the third step. And I said, well, I go to meetings. I hear people talking about a higher power and a power greater than myself and God. He said, they're wrong. A power greater than yourself is anything that can restore you from the insanity of doing it over and over again and expect different results. He said, we're not talking about legal insanity. We're not talking about criminal insanity. We're not talking about mental insanity. We're talking about the insanity of doing it over and over again, but this time it's going to be different. You know, and we all experience that. We get in a relationship, totally dysfunctional. Doesn't work at all. Crazy. And we finally break up. And what do? We get in another relationship with the same person with a different face, a different name. We do it over and over again. We do that with jobs. So that's the insanity that they're talking about. And he said, Vito, even someday, if you wind up believing in God, that God's not going to open the sky and send down angels to work with you. He's always going to work through people, places, and things. Something you hear in a meeting, something you hear in literature, even something an earth person may say to you, make you stop, think about it, and not do it again. And he said, that's all the second step is, being restored to sanity of not doing it over and over again. And then it was time to go to that third step that had the G-O-D word in it, and I was all uptight and everything. But by this time, I was beginning to take a direction, and we made a decision to turn our will and our life over to the care of God as we understood him. And the very first thing that he explained to me, that step does not say God as we understand him. It says God as we understood him. And there's a big difference. And I said, well, what's the big difference? He said, if that step said God as we understand him, that would mean Narcotics Anonymous would have an understanding of God. But because it says understood, each and every one of us can have a different understanding of what God is. And he said, for you, dummy, which is my favorite thing, he said, why don't you just take the word good, G-O-D, and change it to good orderly direction? And that was the first God of my understanding, good orderly direction. And it's changed many times through the years. And then he explained to me, we made a decision. The decision's like making a commitment. You may not be able to fulfill it, but you put the effort into making that decision. We made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood it. What is our will? What is our lives? And he said that your life is everything that happens to you from the time you wake up in the morning to the time you go to bed. And your will is your reaction to everything that happens to you from the time you wake up in the morning to the time you go to bed at night. And he said, all addicts, especially new addicts, have the same problem. And I said, what's that? He said, every addict that comes in here does not respond. They react. Your girlfriend breaks up with you. Boom, I'll show her. I'm going to go out and use like she gives a shit. The bank repossesses your car or your truck. I'm going to show the bank. I'm going to go out and use like they give a damn. Because that's our reaction. Now, we used to have a bumper sticker, what was called the third step bumper sticker. It said, first thought wrong. And what they were talking about, addicts are always reacting. We need to stop, pause, count to 1 to 10 or 1 to 20, and process before we open our mouth. Because our first thought is wrong. She breaks up with me, I'm going to use. But if we take that pause, we may process that if I use, I have to start all over again. And then the result is different. So in the third step, turning our will and our life over to God as we understood him is actually taking a pause, not reaction, process that would just happen. And sometimes the result is completely different. The first three steps, as I said, is the foundation of recovery. They will keep you clean for a while, but it won't keep you clean if you're spiritually dirty and physically clean. And that's why we go on to the fourth step, which said we made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. And I looked at my sponsor and I said, what does morals mean? Because I had no idea. He said, buy a dictionary. And I get to understand that morals is a set of values that we put in life. And we had no four-step guide back then, is what he said. What I want you to do is I want you to write about everything in your addiction. I want you to write about everything and how you felt. And when you get done with, and he gave me topics like relationships, resentments, and stuff like that. He said, but when you finish that, then you have to start writing again. And I said, what do you mean? He said, now I want you to write about how you feel about the way you were when you were in your addiction, how you felt about relationships, resentments, and so forth. He said, one will tell you where you were. The second writing will tell you how much you've grown, because people say you're getting better and you can't realize it, but you'll see that you are growing. And thirdly, it will tell me where I need to work with you with. And that made sense. So I got busy writing all this stuff down. And I remember when I finished, and I don't know how long it was. I know the first time I did it, I did it 24 hours. And he said, you know, and I called him. He said, what are you, crazy? He said, if you wanted to go to confession, I'd drop you off at the Catholic Church. He said, we want you to write more into everything, not so much history, but how you felt and how you feel today. And so I did it. And we are still living in San Diego then, and we went to a little place called Chula Vista, which is a little town between San Diego and Tijuana, Mexican border. And it was all rural then. We're sitting on stones in the desert and so forth. And I started reading all of this stuff. And he said, whoa, you're not going to read that. I said, what do you mean I'm not going to read my manuscript? I had all this work in it. He said, you wrote that to introduce Vito to Vito. I don't give a shit what you got in there. Because what we're doing is the fifth step. And we want to do the exact nature, because the fifth step, we admit it to God, to ourselves and to another person the exact nature. He said, I don't care if you're jealous. I don't care if you're angry. I want to know why, the exact nature, what triggered it, what happened in your life. You know, when something happens and you get angry, it's not because of what's happening now. It's because a trigger of something. When you get jealous, it's not because she's talking to another guy and you want to break her head open. It's because something inside of you feels feelings of abandonment that happened when you were young. And so let's talk about when you get jealous. What was the first time you felt that way? When did you get that feeling for the first time? Same thing with angry. And we went back through my life and we identified the exact nature. He said, because unless we get to the exact nature, you can't do anything. You can say, yeah, I got a problem with anger. Then you're using willpower not to act out. I got a problem with jealousy. But yeah, I'm using willpower. I need to get to the exact nature and get to find out what's going on inside of me to begin to heal that stuff. That's why we sit down with another human being and God and ourselves and find that exact nature. Because unless we find what's going on inside of me, what's making me tick, I can't do anything about it. And so that became a healing thing, identifying why I get angry, why I'm impatient, all these different things. And when it's time to go to the sixth step, he said, take a regular sheet of paper, draw a line down the center. On the left-hand side of the line, list all the things, the defects that we discovered in patterns, and list them all in order. And on the other side of the line, they're obvious. Impatience, patience. Jealousy, tolerance. You know, all these things. This is where I'm at. This is where I need to go. Roadmap to recovery. And he's list them in priority, because you don't want to take a shotgun effect and hit a little bit. You want to do one at a time, a rifle effect. You got jealousy, let's work on that. And when that's all under control, then we go up on the shelf and grab the next one down. And that's how we do the sixth step. And then he identified to me the difference between a defect and a shortcoming. A defect is part of my character, part of who I am. The shortcoming is acting out of the defect. They're rooted in the same word, but they're different. You know, if I feel jealous and I don't act jealousy, I put the shortcoming aside. Because the sixth step is like packing the suitcase. And the seventh step is taking the trip, because seventh step is that we humbly ask him to remove our shortcoming. And I said, well, how do you humbly ask him? He said, any addict that admits that they got the problem and it's on them has become humble. And he said, you've had the formula that God will remove the shortcomings right along. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, it's called the first three steps. When you become jealous, when you feel jealous, don't deny it. Don't use your willpower. Accept that you feel jealous and you're coming apart and everything within you is falling apart. Admit it. Accept it. The first step. And then you go to a second step and you see the insanity if you act out on the feelings that you're feeling. And then you go to a third step and take those feelings and give it to the God of your understanding. And then go back to a second step and do it different. And that's how God removes the shortcomings. Yes, you can pray if you want. You could pray to the God of your choice, but you need to do the footwork, the action, and that is applying the first three steps to all the defects and patterns in your life. And in the eighth step, I said, we made a list of all the persons we had harmed, became willing to make amends to them. And I said to him, everybody owes me Christmas presents. I don't need them to make amends. He says, just do it. And you know, the funny thing about addicts, we go from one extreme to another. So I got busy making the list. Even though I wasn't going to make any amends, by the time I got done, I wanted to go out and make amends to the whole world. And he said, whoa. He said, you can do more damage by doing self-will that way. He said, that's why we have a ninth step. And that's why we do it with our sponsor. It says, we made direct amends to all those, to such people whenever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. And he said, you don't go to your grandmother and say, hey, Gram, you remember when your diamond was missing? Hello. He said, you still have to make those amends, but you make them anonymously so you don't hurt them. And then it says, injure them or others. Who are others? You're part of others. You don't walk, go into the Bronx and go to the 47th or 46th precinct and say, hey, you remember when there was a gang stomping on 179th Street and Arthur Avenue and somebody may have died? You got any cold cases? They'll gladly help you. Going to prison is not making amends. That is not making amends. Stop doing and don't doing those things over again are making amends. I know people have gone, put themselves in jail many years after, But all they're doing is serving a sentence. They're not making amends. Amends is changing your life. And another way that you make amends, for instance, if a guy was cheating on his wife for years and years and years, and he says, I want to clear my conscience, and I'm going to go tell my wife I've been cheating on her for 5 years. That's not an amends. You're causing more damage to your wife. You're doing problems where you're causing damage to her. You're hurting her to clean your conscience. Making amends to your wife is not to do it anymore. That's how you make amends. And so he went through all that process, and he said, well, you're working the fourth step to the ninth step. You're cleaning yourself emotionally, mentally, and spiritually. So I'm not only physically clean now, I'm spiritually clean also. And steps 10, 11, and 12 are the growth and maintenance steps. We maintain what we got through the first nine, and we grow on top of them. The 10th step says we continue to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admit it. And that does not mean walking around saying I'm sorry, because addicts suffer from sorry-itis also. It's okay to apologize, but that's not what they're talking about. Promptly admit it's self-honesty. When I reflect my day, because the 10th step is a very old spiritual principle called reflection. And when I reflect through my day, and when I was wrong and see that I was wrong, I admit it to me. Because if I don't admit it to me, I can't do anything about it. And try not to make those same mistakes over again. It's okay to make mistakes, but it's not okay to keep making the same mistake over and over and over again. And so the 10th step is a very healing process. It's reflection. And I did it for the first 20 years on a written basis. To be honest, I don't do it anymore. But after 20 years of doing it, when my head hits that pillow, I go through a reflection in my head, see where I was wrong, and man, not to do it. So I continue to do the 10th step, even though it's not written. If you do a written 10th step for 20 years, you'll do it automatically. And the 11th step, which I like to call the cornerstone of recovery, even though it's not the cornerstone, it says we sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him. Again, the word understood him. Praying only for the knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry it on. So we sought. That means we're seeker. We're seeking to fill that big empty hole, that spiritual hole within our belly, which we filled with drugs, money, power, sex, food. We're seeking a spiritual solution. And it said we do that through prayer and meditation. And Narcotics Anonymous doesn't tell you how to pray. And they don't tell you who your God is, but it tells you we sought through prayer and meditation. And for me, the highest form of prayer is the word help. Help. I don't need to say anything else. It's already known to an infinite power over me. I just say help. That's my prayer. Help me with this. Help me with that. And meditation is just listening, getting quiet, and letting the answers come. Now, Narcotics Anonymous doesn't tell you how to pray. I mean, how to meditate, but they say you must meditate. And there's 1,000 different ways to meditate. And, you know, a lot of people say, well, I can't still my mind. Well, stilling the mind is not the thing. That's a concept that is totally wrong, because it's like we have a thought pump within us. One thought comes, next thing you know, boom, another thought. It's like a heartbeat, a thought pump. But there's a second gap between these thoughts. And if we learn to go into that gap and meditate and look for God's answer, all of a sudden that 1 second becomes 10 seconds, 10 minutes, 15 minutes, a half hour. You go into the gap and people are amazed. They couldn't stop thinking. But then when they go in that 1 second gap and then they just practice that, and over time, it becomes a deep thing where we go into meditation. Our answers are done at that point. And it says to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood it. And that improving means that we're trying and open now to find what is God's will for us. And what is God's will for us? I remember as a newcomer, we used to sit around and drink coffee all night long, 90 days clean, and we knew what God's will was. What bullshit. But I remember I was at a meeting one time, and there was a lady about 80 years old. She was a little old black lady, her hands all full of arthritis, leaning on a cane. And I used to always talk about God's will, and she took that cane and she put it in my face, and she said, kid, you want to know what God's will is? I'll tell you what God's will is today, tomorrow, and forever. The highest good for anybody in any situation. And boy, that hit me like a thing, because I understand now what that means. If, for instance, if you're a father and you wind up getting a divorce and you got 3 kids, and the judge says to you, you got to pay so much child support each month. And I say, I don't want to pay it. I do not want to pay it because she'll use it on drugs or booze or give it to her boyfriend. And she said, that doesn't make any difference. You need to do it because that's your responsibility to do it. So 20 years from now, you can look into your kids' eyes and say, I paid child support for you every week. What your mother did for it is none of my business. I did what I took care of my responsibility. That was the highest good for any situation. So as an addict, we look at any situation, not what's the highest good for me, but what is the highest good for everybody. And that will always be God's will. And that's why at the end of that step, it says, praying for the knowledge of his will and the power to carry it out. Because the power to carry it out is the hard part. Because as an addict, I'm self-centered and I want what I think is best for me. And I need to unceasingly pray all the time that I can carry God's will out, which is the highest good for everybody concerned. And that's why I say that's the cornerstone. And the 12th step is a portal to real life. It says, having had a spiritual awakening, as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to addicts and practice these principles in all our affairs. And what is that spiritual awakening? I hear addicts going on and on about that. It's very simple. The spiritual awakening is these steps work. Simple as that. These steps work. And why is it simple, spiritual awakening? Because it may not cure a relationship problem, a money problem, a job problem. But what it will do, it will carry me through that challenge and come out the other side without using. And that's why the steps are always the answer. And then we carry the message of the steps to other addicts. And that's why I say, if you're going into jails, rehabs and so forth, and not carrying the message that the steps are the answer, you're not doing 12-step work. We carry the message that the steps will get us through things. They won't solve the problem, but they will get us through those challenges. And then it says to practice in all our affairs, which means I cannot stop using the steps. How can I carry the message of the steps if I'm not continuing? And that's why the 12 steps are always the answer. And I'd like to say that life is good without the steps, and with the steps, but there are still challenges. If you're in rehab right now and you come out, you're going to find out that nothing in life has changed. The same challenges that were out there when you walked in are there today. The difference is the change in you, that you understand that life doesn't change. My perception and my reaction to life has to be completely different. Life stays the same. Just because you spent 30, 60, 90 days in a rehab means absolutely nothing. What means thing is in that rehab, you've learned that the world will be the same, but I am different and I don't have to use over those problems. And that's why the steps are the answer. And I practiced it for many years. Have I been good at it? No. I remember when I had 20 years clean. I had a trauma in my family and I couldn't handle it. And although I knew I was going to go out and use, I felt everything. And so I took the easier and softer way. I tied a rope around my neck, jumped off a chair, and wanted to end my life. And thank God the girl that I was married to at that time cut the rope. Because otherwise, I would have been dead. And that reason only thing happened because I stopped going to meetings for 1 year. And during that 1 year, that 20 years of recovery, even though I didn't relapse, began to erode on me. And so they took me to a mental institution because I tried to kill myself. And when I went in, I had input with the psychiatrist. And when she got all done, she said, I'm not going to commit you. She says, your biggest problem is you are an addict without a program. If I don't commit you, get your ass to a meeting. And I said, yeah. And in my head, the words of my sponsor rang and rang. It said, when you're green, you're growing. When you're ripe, you begin to rot. And because I didn't go to meetings for a year, I began to rot. And it put me at the end of a rope. Or I could have used. And that's why meeting makers make it. And they make it also because they see what happens to people who don't go to meetings. And a lot of people are like, oh, meeting makers, what do they do? They make meetings. Yes, they make meetings to see what happens to people who don't go to meetings. Meeting makers will always make it. The program of Narcotics Anonymous works, but I have to be willing to work the program. It doesn't happen by osmosis. In the chapter 5, in the basic text, what can we do? It says we work the steps with our sponsor, preparing for the spiritual awakening of living the steps in our life. And if we've been here for a while and we're still working steps and not living them, we're in big trouble. Because we do work steps for the spiritual awakening of living them in our life. And that's the beauty of it. I've been here a long time. I could go through. My life has challenges. I had open heart surgery. With it last March, they had 90, the two of my arteries were 98% blocked. I was just about ready to die. God decided I didn't. They fixed it. I come back. The year before that, I had prostate cancer, went through 45 straight days of radiation. I'm still here today because God said, I'm not done serving. And that's why I still go to 4 or 5 meetings a week, because I need to give what was so freely given to me. If I stop going, I could be replaced by somebody else. God will say, goodbye. I got to put another person on earth to take care of that stuff. I will serve until I'm not able to serve anymore. I just can't stop doing it, because I know this is a God-given program. And how do you say no to somebody that gave you a life? And that's why I keep coming. And I'm going to end right now with a little story. And this story is called Joe Addict. Most of us know Joe Addict. Joe Addict, you know, but he was a smart addict. He can continue to go. He was a heroin addict like me, but he was smart. He made sure that he had enough stash put away every night, so when he got up in the morning, he could fix himself so he doesn't have those razor blades in his belly and have to go out and do some crazy stuff to the cop. And so Joe was invited to a little party, and there was a bunch of using addicts there, and Joe was a little bit on the horny side. So he's looking across the room, and his girl's giving him the eye, and Joe's giving the eye, and Joe Mosey gets across the room a little bit, and he comes up there, and she says, Joe, if you got a little, I got a little. And Joe's horny as hell, and he says, yeah. He says, do you have an apartment? She says, yeah. She says, let's go. And they slip out of the party, and they go to her party apartment. All of a sudden, the next thing Joe knows, it's 6 o'clock in the morning, the sun's coming up, his stash is gone. They're both stoned high. He gets up and says, shit, it's 6 o'clock in the morning. My stash is gone. I got to go out and score somewhere. Now it's 6 o'clock in the morning. He's got to put a hustle on someone. He's walking down the street. Some damn city worker left the manhole cover open. Boom, Joe goes down 20 feet underneath the ground. He's, oh my God, I'm here and trapped in this manhole. The devil's coming. The pillars of hell, I'm going to be eaten alive. I need to use. I'm getting sick. There's no hope for me. And a voice from the top says, what's going on down there? And he said, I'm Joe Addict, and I'm dying of the disease of addiction, and there's no help for me. The guy said, well, you're in luck, son. I'm a man of the cloth. I'm a minister. And he brings out his Bible, and he starts praying over him. He said, you'll be okay now, Joe. And he goes, and Joe said, you're crazy. People have been praying over me all my life, and there's been no help. And now it's even worse. And he's carrying on. Another voice comes down there, and he says, what's going on down there? I'm Joe Addict, and I'm dying of the disease of addiction, and there's no help for me. And the guy said, well, you're in luck. I'm an MD, and I got my prescription pad. Writes a little Dilatas, a little Oxycontin, Percocets, and here, Joe, here's the scripts. Go out. You're okay now. And he takes off, and Joe says, oh, crazy. I got these scripts on, and I can't get them filled, and I'm dying. I'm dying. I'm dying. And another voice comes in. It's a very soft voice, and it had a bit of a little Scottish brogue to it. And it says, what's going on down there? He says, I'm Joe Addict. I'm dying from the disease of addiction, and there's no help for me. There's no help for me at all. I'm dying. And this little frail man jumps down in that manhole, and Joe says, are you crazy? Now there's two of us, and there's no way out. And the man says in the Scottish brogue, he said, I've been here before. I know the way out. My name is Jimmy Kennan, and I founded Narcotics Anonymous. Follow me. Thanks for letting me share.
Unbelievable, Vito. Thank you so much. Can we all unmute and thank Vito for that beautiful?
Thank you.
Oh, great.
Thank you, Vito. Thank you, Vito.
Thank you, Vito.
Thank you, Vito.
Thank you, Vito.
Thank you, Vito.
Thank you, Vito.